Okay, Mike, there's a lot of material to cover here today. Trying not to get bogged down too much in the various psychodramas of the month. Let's start just briefly by talking about some of the history of sexual harassment campaigns, legal advances, and then turn to some of the dynamics now with cases like Harvey Weinberg on Weinberger.
Weinstein.
That was some kind of slip. But that's a topic for another day as well. So Weinstein and powerful men. Henry Kissinger's famous line, power is ultimate aphrodisiac, and the question is for whom. But let's talk about some of that history and what some of the gains were around the sexual harassment legislation that came out of second wave feminism in the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Well, sexual harassment was not against the law, nor was sexual discrimination until 1964. And then the inclusion of women in that law was a casual, almost afterthought. It was primarily a race-based law. But as of 1965, the EEOC was formed, and the term sexual harassment came into the law in 1980. That's when the EEOC formally recognized that as a form of discrimination. So since then, it's been a very active area of the law. People have been suing and countersuing. Corporations have developed programs largely to avoid being sued, but they nonetheless now have training for how not to sexually harass people. It's been a constant. It remains a constant, but it's also being fought on all sorts of different fronts with increasing effectiveness. And I think the Weinstein incident is an opportunity. It's a wave. A wave is breaking. And before it recedes, hopefully there will be some institutional changes made.
I think that there is both the advances on the legal front and that behavior, and on the cultural level, behavior that was quite acceptable in the 1950s around racism and sexism, you know, jokes about the boss chasing his secretary around the desk. It's not funny anymore, and it's not acceptable, even though it's still done. And so behavior that was once considered natural is now subject to new rules. And of course, humans have evolved for the capacity to respond to changing rules. There was a time when you could walk into someone's house, light up a cigarette, and no one would blink. And now that would be considered very bizarre in most instances. So the question then is, given this atmosphere of changing norms and legal consequences, do we judge differently the behavior of men that's quite persistent on extreme end of a continuum? And if they're not just outliers, but a symptom of something deeper going on that perhaps can't be addressed solely through litigation or law, how do we understand the persistence of this behavior now, the pervasiveness of it, recognizing that there's a continuum and that Harvey Weinstein, is that right?
I refuse
to know who this guy is. Harvey Weinstein's behavior is a pattern of extreme predatory behavior, knowing and having severe consequences, like Bill O'Reilly. I mean, what would you say to him as a lawyer? I'll let you know in a minute what I would say as a therapist. But what would you say as a lawyer to someone who, knowing these legal consequences, maybe he's gone through the various trainings you suggested, but there's a persistence of this pattern of behavior and other people know about it. What would you say to him if you were his counsel?
Cut it out, Bill.
Bill, Harvey, whatever.
You're a heavier and heavier weight for our network. We can't carry you anymore if you keep doing this.
Yeah. Well, and it is interesting. Getting back to, and I would say as a psychologist, what is it that makes power an aphrodisiac and for whom? I mean, there's a pattern, there's a series of studies carried out by social psychologists that argue that people who are assigned power, even in a social experiment, assigned more weight, more power than other people, tend to lose the capacity to pick up on cues. They have less empathic capacity to read the cues of others. They tend to claim more than their share of the goods in the group. And powerful men tend to misread cues of women and think that it's a sign of attraction when there's something else going on. So there's that level of misreading.
Well, Jan, these are eternal factors. I mean, men back in the day when skeletal muscles were very important have been dominant forever. And this has...
Depends on which anthropology you're reading. There are a history of societies where this was more or less prominent. It's much more associated with patriarchal society where there's concentration of power in the hands of men and a conflict over resources. So
the extraordinary thing to me is how it is being truly checked despite the nature of biology, you know, fundamental characteristics. Like when I was 11 years old, my pupils suddenly started to dilate when I saw a breast. I didn't ask for that to happen.
My pupils dilated when I saw a little kid next to me with a better lunch, but I learned I couldn't just grab it. You learn that too.
You can be socialized.
What makes then some people, and what is the social context that goes from dilated pupils to feeling you are entitled to prey upon someone, and you can kind of indulge the fantasy that they want it, because that's often part of predation, is the fantasy that actually the victim really wants this.
Right. Well, I'm sure Donald Trump, lacking any insight at all, believes that women that have been attracted to him have not cared about his money at all, have never known that. I mean, there are that fact of predators overlooking their power. Harvey Weinstein could offer everything to young women because he could position them. I mean, everybody in every industry, there are promotions available to people who the boss likes. There's opportunities to advance dependent on your superior.
And that is exciting. And that gets misread as sexual interest. I would imagine that in many of these encounters, there were excited women and young women filled with hope and promises that, of course, largely were unrealized. But he probably did make some deals, and I apparently did advance the careers of some young woman. But I think there's another dynamic here that operates in political environments or economic environments, workplace environments, where there's a lot of power dynamics, is that it also generates anxiety in people. Because as Harvey Weinstein's finding, it's power can collapse, and reliance on women to kind of hold up a fantasy of invincibility, a fantasy that is more precarious than it might seem.
Well, the way to change that is to make it sting if it's discovered. And there's been a host of laws and training that have made appreciable impact. And I think they need to continue. And people need, on many, many fronts, you know, the issue now is hotly debated, is the role of private settlements. Now, people, because there is a law, because there are consequences, it's worth paying somebody off to move on to whatever's next. But on the one hand, private settlements mean there's no record. You could be a serial predator and do this repeatedly and no one would know. But on the other hand, if there are private settlements, there are more likely to be settlements. But I think if there's some way of having a list or a repository, if you're not necessarily a union for women, that's a very charged term, but it's a database, that's a nice neutral term, where if people have had reached some kind of settlement or have been in some way or another publicly acknowledged to have been a harasser, that there's a record kept.
But this is also a symptom of concentration of power. And I think it's, to the extent it's a symptom of something about patriarchy and hierarchy and concentration of power, it's important to also socialize institutions in a way and think about how power is distributed for the creation of popular culture and expanding the role of women at all different levels and democratizing some of those institutions?
Well, the nature in Hollywood in particular of power is that it's pyramidal. I mean, a movie is an elaborate, it's as elaborate as building pyramids in a literal sense. And you see now the credits at the end of a movie, there's 1,000, 2,000 people.
Well, and there's a lot of money riding on the big commercial ones. And that also generates a lot of anxiety for people and a lot of this kind of bad behavior.
Well, the
I think we should stop going to a lot of them are not worth the millions of dollars that go into production. But
well, there's not going to be a change in that structure of making the movie. There has to be someone charged with making decisions. Interestingly, women have appeared more as producers. So producers, you have to make reach a consensus if you've got different money coming in from different places. But the actual production part, directors, males remain on top for the most part. But that can be changed, even though you cannot change the hierarchical nature.
Well, that's maybe a subject for another day. That's true to some extent. But there are a range of ways films are made around the world. And the classical Hollywood model, which itself has gone through periods of crisis where it's almost collapsed. But the point we're making is that there are a lot of levels for responding to this issue, and that there's been progress made, and men cannot just get away with it as they once did.
There's been tremendous change over the last 50 years. Yeah. I think it's a combination of cultural change and legal consequences to actions, and that if people persist, changes can continue.
Yeah. So we'll end on that hopeful note. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about sexual harassment today.
Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and be feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling alright. Everybody will be dancing tonight doing it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and be feeling it right.